that we'd like to use for 5G in the United States is already occupied by other users. So we have to figure out ways to shuffle things around and make more of that spectrum available for 5Gs.
So shuffle, what would this mean for instance, satellite companies?
So the industry giants in the space, Intelsat and SES, haven't been opposed to selling their spectrum, but they've wanted a not public but private auction to get a piece of the action. And there's talk of a lawsuit.
All right. That's Marketplace's Erica Barris. Thank you. The embattled West Coast utility PG&E is in bankruptcy court today trying to reorganize its obligations, with its system getting blamed for deadly California wildfires. The company's making a complex argument to try to reduce an estimated $30 billion in liability, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
PG&E is arguing against a legal concept called inverse condemnation. It lets California homeowners sue the utility for causing wildfires. And under inverse condemnation, they don't even have to show that PG&E was negligent, according to Shelley Ross Saxer at Pepperdine Law.
It's the landowner that brings the claim to say they are entitled to just compensation.
PG&E says it should only be on the hook if it can pass its costs on to the public by raising rates, which it's not allowed to do. Robert Thomas, a lawyer at Damon Key, says if PG&E wins the argument, its liability could go way down.
From their perspective, yes, having the monkey of inverse condemnation off your back, that would be very nice. I mean, I would breathe a lot easier.
On the other side of the argument are fire victims and insurance companies who say utilities should pay for problems they cause. This case goes to the broader question of who pays for damage from disasters as fires and floods get more frequent. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Checking numbers, half hour before the opening bell, the Dow is up 0.1%, the S&P up 0.2%. Those are futures, of course. The home declutterer Supreme, Marie Kondo, wants you to buy more stuff to put into your home. Kondo, whose books on the Japanese art of tidying up and folding T-shirts precisely led to a Netflix series, has now opened KonMari. It's an online store to sell stuff to put on those now empty shelves and tables.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments, taking a personalized approach to helping clients grow, preserve, and manage their wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by the New Economy Forum. This November, people with the power to change the world gather in Beijing to chart a new path forward. NewEconomyForum.com.
Maybe not since the dawn of time, but all through the 20th century into the 21st, the cost of Wall Street middlemen and middlewomen has stayed close to 2%. But after all these years, data now show their cut from running investment portfolios or facilitating financial transactions is getting squeezed, with some interesting social consequences. The person with the data is Thomas Philippon, a professor of finance at New York University's Stern School. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
This 2% fee was typical for what? Just about everything? Buying a stock or a bond or selling?
I found, much to my surprise, that this unit cost had not really changed for a century. And when I updated my research last year, I saw that finally, since maybe the past 10 years, we see a small but significant decline in the average cost of financial services.
What do you think it is? New technology? I mean, we talk about this phrase fintech, financial technology. I mean, I guess you could think of that as kind of like Uber finally squeezing taxi fares. New technology comes to Wall Street.
Yeah, I think it's always a combination of two things. It's technology and competition. Finally, today, what we see is actually both, thanks to fintech. But fintech is done both by small firms like startups, but also, of course, the large firms are also doing fintech. And thanks to that, I think we see finally a decrease in the cost of finance.
Yeah, you have these robo-advisors. Instead of paying a more expensive human being to give you some stock advice, a little voice can come on the phone or through your computer and try to assess your risk profile and so forth, and that can bring costs down, things like that.
Absolutely, yeah. So then the thing that was really interesting to me is first to show that finally we have some, you know, improvement in the cost of finance, but then to think more deeply about who's going to benefit from it. It turns out that people had very mixed feeling and mixed views about it, because they thought if you want to have a good AI system for robo-advising, it has to be huge because the fixed costs are so big that you need to have a massive portfolio to do it. And somehow people thought, well, anything big is not going to be that good for the little guys. And I think in that case, it's wrong, actually. Now with AI and with these robo-advisors, I think the cost of having good professional-level advice for portfolio management is going to come down a lot, which means that people with less wealth to invest will be able to afford these services. And so my prediction is that we're going to see a democratization of access to finance, at least on the portfolio side.
Thomas Philippon at NYU's Stern School of Business. The paper is called On FinTech and Financial Inclusion, published as a working paper at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Philippon has just come out with a new book about concentration of corporate power. It's called The Great Reversal, How America Gave Up on Free Markets. Watch this space for more on that. Our producers are Rose Conlon, Victoria Craig, Meredith Gerritsen, Candice Manriquez-Wren, and Daniel Shin. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
A 59 on this Tuesday morning. You are listening to your local news and information source for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands. Glad to have you with us for Morning Edition. Stay with us. We bring you The Point with Mindy Todd on 90.1 WCAI and WCAI HD1 Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, 91.1 WNAN Nantucket, 94.3 WZAI Brewster, and WGBH HD3 89.7 Boston. Online, capeandislands.org. Mostly cloudy here in Woods Hole, 44 degrees with light winds. National Weather Service says to expect cloudy skies today. Temps topping out in the mid to upper 40s. Clouds again tonight and tomorrow. Temps only dropping a few degrees tonight into the low 40s, mainly around the region. Temps in the mid 40s around the region tomorrow. Sun expected to return for Thursday.
I'm Jay Allison. This Thursday evening, we hope you'll join us for a free public listening event featuring the new stories produced by the participants in the Transom Story Workshop. The stories are always great, and who knows, maybe one is about you. The event is Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Woods Hole Community Hall. It's free. Please come early to get your seats. For more information, go to capeandislands.org.
Coming up on The Point, strengthening our democracy. Manipulating congressional district maps to favor one political party over another is not a new strategy. Yet over the past decade, maps across the country were gerrymandered to favor Republican candidates. We discuss efforts underway to make congressional maps more reflective of the population and ways we can make Massachusetts governing bodies better reflect the diversity of our state. The Point, coming up right after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Public hearings for the House impeachment inquiry are getting underway this hour. Four witnesses are scheduled for today. NPR's Miles Parks says lawmakers will hear from people who were assigned to listen to President Trump's July phone call with the president of Ukraine.
First, the House Intelligence Committee will hear from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman and Jennifer Williams. Both listened in on the phone call that's at the center of the investigation into whether President Trump withheld critical foreign aid money from Ukraine to help himself politically. Vindman was the top Ukraine specialist on the National Security Council, and he reported his concerns about the call to a Security Council attorney. This afternoon, Kurt Volker and Tim Morrison are scheduled. Volker was one of three diplomats tasked with Ukraine policy by the president. He's resigned. And Morrison is an outgoing aide who testified behind closed doors that after listening to the July phone call, he did not think anything improper happened. Miles Parks, NPR News, Washington.
A new NPR, PBS NewsHour, Marist poll finds the majority of Americans say they don't think the inquiry can change their minds about whether President Trump should be impeached. NPR's Domenico Montanaro has more.
Two-thirds of people say their minds are all but made up about whether President Trump should be impeached, and they cannot imagine anything coming out in the public hearings that can change their view. Just 30% say they could be swayed. It's a real tangible example of just how entrenched partisanship is in this country. It's also a reason why views of President Trump have remained so remarkably steady since he took office. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
The United Nations Human Rights Office is demanding that Iran's government stop using live ammunition against protesters. Demonstrators are objecting to a 50% price hike in the cost of gas. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports Iran's supreme leader backs the price increase. He says the protesters are thugs.
Iranian security forces clashed with demonstrators over the weekend after banks and government buildings were damaged or set on fire. Monday, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps warned of a decisive response if the protests continued. Several people, including members of the security services, were reported killed. Images on social media became fewer after Tehran cut internet access late Saturday, but some videos did emerge showing protests continuing Monday night. The protests are similar to ones held 2 years ago, also sparked by economic complaints, but then turning into general anti-regime demonstrations. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Swedish prosecutors say that they are dropping an investigation into sexual assault claims against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. He has repeatedly denied the accusations. Assange is currently jailed in Britain for skipping bail. Assange is also fighting extradition to the United States. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Hanes, donating 250,000 pairs of socks to homeless shelters in all 50 states, and more than 3 million pairs since 2009. Information on how to help the homeless is at Hanes.com/sock drive.
It's 9:04. Good morning. I'm Catherine Ident in Woods Hole with some local news. Voters at Brewstertown meeting last night approved funding to study the feasibility of consolidating the town's two elementary schools. An amendment was raised on town meeting floor that called for the study, and it was in response to a non-binding petition article that called to combine the two schools into one and to use the vacant school as a community and senior center. The petition was proposed as a way to keep taxes down as the town's student population, like that of much of Cape Cod, is on the decline. A report on the plane crash in a New Bedford cemetery earlier this month finds the plane was in working order and was not to blame. Paul Vidal of Westport was the only person aboard the plane when it hit a tree shortly after takeoff. The 74-year-old died in the crash. Federal investigators are still looking for answers as to why the Cessna plane went into a nosedive. They do say that spark plugs found in the wreckage were deemed to be in working order. The remains of what appears to be a wooden ship on Nauset Beach in Orleans, exposed at low tide. Cape Cod historian and writer Don Wilding says it's often difficult to identify ships that are exposed by shifting sands.
Between Provincetown and Monomoy, from 1626 or so to the middle of the 20th century, there were probably in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 4,000 shipwrecks.
The wooden ship is not believed to be the wreckage from the Orchid. That ship sank in 1896, and it was seen a few years ago when storms exposed that wreck at Nauset Beach. In sports, Celtics beat the Suns in Phoenix last night, 99-85. Bruins play the New Jersey Devils tonight at 7 o'clock. And your forecast, National Weather Service calling for clouds today, tonight, and tomorrow. Highs topping out today in the mid to upper 40s with light winds out of the west. We have temperatures in the low 40s around the region right now. Temps dropping just a few degrees back into the low 40s tonight, and then topping out in the mid 40s tomorrow. Sun expected to return for Thursday. It's 9:06. You're listening to WCAI.
Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Our country feels increasingly polarized. Partisan politics in Congress is often pointed to as an example of how divided we've become. Have the values and beliefs of the American people changed radically over the past decade, or is something else going on? Turns out many U.S. congressional district maps were redrawn a decade ago to favor Republican candidates. Once in office, these representatives have little incentive to work with Democrats since their reelection is almost guaranteed. Later in the hour, we discuss efforts to make congressional districts maps better reflect the political diversity of communities. We also talk with the co-author of a new report highlighting how Massachusetts governing bodies can better reflect the political, racial, and gender diversity of the state. But first, how did congressional district maps become so manipulated? We welcome David Daly. He's the author of a book that we can't say the entire title on the air, so we'll say Rat Bleeped, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. Welcome.
Good morning.
So before we get to the manipulation of the congressional districts, explain how congressional district maps are drawn and how often that happens.
Well, every 10 years, we redraw every state legislative and congressional district in the country after the census to account for population changes. The idea is you want all of those districts to have an equal number of people in them. So elections in 0 years and years ending in zero matter an awful lot because as soon as the census comes out, in the spring of 2011 or 2021, the state legislatures in most of these states to get to work drawing the lines. And in most states across the country, it's the state legislatures that have control of this process. So if you take a power of the state legislative chambers in a year ending in zero, it gives you a real advantage over the course of the next decade.
Mm. Now, gerrymandering or manipulating congressional district maps for partisan purposes is nothing new. So where did this term gerrymandering come from?
Well, it comes from right here in Massachusetts. There was a governor of Massachusetts named Elbridge Gerry with a G, and back in 1812, his party, the Republican-Democrat Party, drew the state Senate districts around Boston in such a fanciful, wild way to entrench themselves against the hated Federalists that a political cartoonist saw that the shape of the districts and drew a salamander out of them. And the word became known as the gerrymander, that they put the governor's name together with salamander. And Elbridge Gerry, who actually opposed those maps, and had a distinguished career as a signer of the Declaration of Independence, a vice president of the United States, nevertheless goes down in historical infamy as the creator of this horrible anti-democratic practice.
Now, in the 2008 election, Barack Obama wins the White House, and Democrats take the majority in the House and Senate. So what was the response of the Republicans, specifically strategist Chris Jankowski?
I think that's really interesting, and it's really important because a lot of people remember 2008 as this historic election, right? The election of our first black president. Democrats win a supermajority in the U.S. Senate, and they also hold on to the U.S. House. If you go back and look at the footage of that night, a lot of people were talking about how the demographic changes in this country were going to render the Republicans a minority party for possibly a generation to come. And it didn't exactly work out that way. And one of the reasons is a strategist named Chris Jankowski, who works in state legislatures, understands that 2008 might have been a very important year, but 2010, it's one of those zero years that we were talking about. It's a census year. And what he knew was that if they launched a really effective strategy to win as many state legislative chambers as Republicans possibly could in 2010, a year that was likely to go in their favor anyway, because oftentimes the first midterm election of a Democratic president is a good backlash year for the Republicans and vice versa. So they spend $30 million targeting these inexpensive state legislative races around the country, particularly in swing states, closely divided states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Florida, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and it is, in fact, a big Republican year. 2010 is the Tea Party year. It's the backlash against Obamacare. At the end of the election, Obama goes out the next day and says that the Democrats were walloped the night before. But the thing that nobody, perhaps except Chris Jankowski, understood that night is that the gains that the Republicans made in 2010 were going to last for an entire decade because it was a redistricting year.
Yeah. So how did strategists know how to manipulate districts to ensure the Republican majorities? You know, how much information did they have on the individuals living in these areas, and where did that information come from?
Oh, it's
complicated, right?
An unbelievable amount of information. And it's one of the reasons why the gerrymanders that happened in 2010 are so much intensive and have been so much harder to roll back than any other in our history, right? Because, you know, this goes back to Elbridge Gerry in 1812. You can trace it back even further. I mean, Patrick Henry tries to gerrymander James Madison out of the very first Continental Congress. As long as we've had politicians, they have wanted to try to gain every advantage that they can, and drawing their own district lines is an amazing advantage to have. But by 2010, the computer software that is being used to draw these maps, the programs are so sophisticated and precise. The data that is available on Americans has just multiplied. Mm. You start off with all the demographic detail in the census. that is, you know, broken down essentially to a block level. So simply by using the census, you have a really good block-by-block understanding of who lives on what street and what their demographics and economic status would be. But then you can factor into this as well all of the public records, all of the databases, you know, driver's license databases, tax databases, voting registrations, and what year did you vote in, what year did you not vote in, do you have a gun license? And all of that, that tells you even more about the person who lives at that house. And then there's just, you know, reams of private information that can be purchased, magazine subscriptions, social media, web searches, purchases online, all of which is available for pennies on the dollar. It can be uploaded into this incredibly sophisticated map-making software that, and on these computers that are just so fast, and they can go up and down streets. Whenever you see a gerrymandered district and you see a line that looks a little bit funny, and maybe you say that's a salamander or that's, you know, Donald Duck kicking Goofy or whatever Rorschach test you see in it, it was drawn that way for a reason, because the map maker knows who lives there and what the political intent and purpose will be of drawing that line.
So give us a sense how distorted the maps drawn in 2011 are.
They are the most distorted maps in our history in many states. Right now, for example, we have 59 million Americans living in a state where one or both chambers of their state legislature is controlled by the party that won fewer votes in the 2018 election. You have a situation in which a state like North Carolina, which is, you know, very closely divided between Republicans and Democrats, has had a 10-3 Republican advantage in its congressional delegation that has stayed that way all decade. Democrats haven't flipped a single seat. It's the same in Ohio. Ohio is kind of the classic bellwether state, right? It's a 12-4 breakdown in Congress for the Republicans. It's stayed that way this entire decade. And I think if you look at the state of Wisconsin, perhaps that is the most gerrymandered state in the country right now, or the most effectively gerrymandered. If you look at the election results there in 2018, Democrats won the governorship there. They won every statewide office, like Secretary of State and Attorney General. They won the U.S. Senate race, and they won 190,000 more votes than Republicans for the state assembly, except that was only enough to shift one seat in the assembly, which Republicans still hold a supermajority in, 63-36.
So what were Democrats doing as the Republicans executed this redistricting plan? I mean, I think I read in one of your interviews, Karl Rove actually said they were going to do this, right? Were they just not paying attention?
Because it was done in plain sight. You know, it's perfectly legal. It's, you know, it's like Moneyball in many ways, right? You know, I mean, Billy Bean of the Oakland A's and the Brad Pitt movie, they find the bargain, and state legislative races were the bargain. And I mean, Karl Rove writes an op-ed in March of 2010 in the Wall Street Journal, and he says, we are going to win all of these state legislative races this year. We're going to spend $30 million on this plan, and it's going to entrench us in power in many of these states and also in Congress for the next decade. I don't know if Democrats simply didn't get their Wall Street Journal that day, that they were too busy listening to NPR. But, I mean, I think that there was a certain hubris that set in amongst Democrats after 2008. They had just won this huge sweeping victory. They really did believe that they had this coalition of the ascendant, that all the demographic forces in the country were trending in their direction. And they fell asleep on the importance of redistricting at exactly the time that these really smart strategists inside the Republican Party conceived of a new paradigm for using redistricting as a way to maximize partisan advantage.
Yeah. Now, have there been any challenges in the courts to these gerrymandered districts? And if so, what are the rulings?
They're all over the map. There have been an awful lot of challenges this decade. The courts have been loaded with them. And they've been very successful in federal courts. You had federal courts in Ohio, Maryland, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Michigan that all overturned these maps as unconstitutional, except that back in the spring, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a narrow 5-4 decision from the cases in North Carolina and Maryland, essentially slammed the door of the federal courthouses to further partisan gerrymandering claims. They called it a political question that the federal courts were not suited to handle. So what you are seeing now is an increasing number of challenges in state court using state constitutions that more often than not have a really healthy protection of voting rights and also fair and free election clauses. Hmm. So in 2018 in Pennsylvania, there was a challenge under the state constitution to the Pennsylvania congressional map, which had been rigged to favor Republicans 13-5, so 71% of the seats in a blue state in which Democrats routinely got 52-53% of the vote. They would have, you know, less than a quarter of the seats. And that map was overturned. A new map was drawn by an independent special master. And in 2018, it produced the kind of results you would imagine, a 9-9. You know, dead even partisan breakdown in this even state. You've had a similar successful challenge in North Carolina, where that 10-3 map was struck down in state court as well as an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander, and they're in the process right now of drawing a new map that will be used in 2020.
So 2020, an election year and time for another census. Is it too early to tell if Democrats can take back state legislative seats in some of these key states like Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, which would give them opportunities to redraw congressional district maps in 2021? Yeah.
Here we go again, right? I mean, we're right back. You know, a lot of people focus on a presidential year or taking back the Senate. What happens in these state legislatures in many ways matters more, because this is going to be the playing field for our politics for the next 10 years. Mm. There's not another shot at these maps until 2031. Every state's a little bit different as far as how they work. Democrats have not had a lot of luck winning back state legislatures in any of those gerrymandered states. In Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Republicans are still in charge in all of those states. Democrats have won veto power by winning governor's offices in some of those states. But I imagine that there will be, you know, many court challenges. In Michigan, voters were so fed up with gerrymandering that they backed a constitutional amendment in 2018 that created an independent redistricting commission. So there will be, you know, nonpartisan citizens drawing lines in Michigan in 2021, but we will have to see in many of these other states. And Republicans already have a new plan. Just as Democrats kind of catch up to the old one, in many states, Republicans are talking about changing the rules and drawing these districts not based on total population, which has been the standard in this country for, you know, going back decades, but based on citizen voting age population, which would have the effect, especially in a state like Texas or Georgia, of making the population whiter, older, more conservative, more rural. So keep an eye on that as well.
So how does ranked choice voting work, and could it help lessen the impact of manipulated congressional district maps?
Yeah, I think it could in many ways. And, I mean, look at Massachusetts for, you know, one example. And there's a couple of ways I think that this would work. If you look, for example, at Nikki Tsongas' seat after she retired, you had 9 or 10 Democratic candidates running in a primary there that was essentially going to determine the winner in this very Democratic district. All you had to do was kind of get through that primary. And the winner of that primary won with 21% of the vote because, you know, there were so many candidates, so it was divided in so many ways. Now imagine if you used ranked choice, which kind of functions as an instant runoff in a case like that. You would automatically have a winner that didn't simply represent the most fervent base in that district. You would have a winner that actually had 50% of the vote. So that seems like it would be super valuable at a time, especially in Massachusetts, which is largely a one-party state, especially at the congressional level. And winning the party primary is essentially tantamount to winning the general election. And we all know that the best way to win a party primary, which is generally low turnout, is to be the strongest advocate of the most hardcore base of the party. And what you end up with in that case is a winner with just over 20% of the vote in a low turnout summer primary who represents everybody. And it just seems like we would be in much better shape. And we would elect members of Congress and politicians who had more incentive to be speaking to all of us and campaigning to all of us and then governing in a more collegial and compromising style if we are able to use ranked choice.
David Daley is the author of Rat Bleeped, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. We'll post a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. David, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up after break, we discuss efforts to create fair political maps nationwide. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing how to improve our representative democracy this hour. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. It's not in dispute that in many states, U.S. congressional district maps have been manipulated to favor Republican candidates. The League of Women Voters is working to change that. Joining us from our studios at WGBH is Judy Zenbrecker.
Zahnbrecker,
thank you. I'm having trouble speaking this morning. Co-president of the Massachusetts chapter of the League of Women Voters, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. So, Judy, for those who might be unfamiliar with the League of Women Voters, tell us a little bit about the background and the mission of the organization.
Certainly. The League of Women Voters is going to be turning 100 years old on February of 2020, and our state league will be 100 years old starting in May of 2020. The League of Women Voters was founded by some of the people who led women's suffrage, and it was designed as what was called a mighty political experiment, with the objective to register the 20 million women who had or would be shortly receiving the right to vote and to train them on how to vote, because recall many of the women had never voted or had voted in just limited elections in the local school districts. And then they decided it was very important that that the voters, and obviously the women, but really all voters, really understand the issues. So they embarked on studying issues, debating them, and getting that information out in a nonpartisan way. So they felt it was very important, the founders of the League, that we are a nonpartisan organization and that we do not support or promote any political party or candidate in any election overall. But we are political in terms of we do study issues from all sides, and then we reach consensus on how to develop a position that we then move forward with. When it was first founded, they thought, the founders thought, oh, this will last about maybe 5-10 years. And as you can see, we still are at it because we see that there's continued need to educate voters and to also advocate for many of the things that we've always advocated for, including education reform. Redistricting has been something that has long been on the League's agenda because we feel that is fundamental for having a healthy, having an appropriate representation in our representative democracy at all levels of government.
Yeah. We should say this is not an organization just for women.
No, it's not. It's open to anyone who wants to join.
All right. So what do you consider the characteristics of a fair congressional district map?
Well, we look at it as a process. So what we're focused on is making sure that the process is done in a way that the people of the district, the people of whatever the jurisdiction is, they pick their representative and not the other way around. So in the process of developing the districts, we think it is very important that it is a nonpartisan process. So the so it's not like who's in power. We talked about the Republicans. Democrats also gerrymander, as they apparently did in Maryland. That was one of the cases that went to the Supreme Court this past summer. And that the process, we optimally would see it being run by a nonpartisan board that has been appointed, and that the process that is used is open, that there are public hearings with public input, that is run under open meeting law, for instance, and that every step of the way people know what's going on and that the public does have input into it. Preferably, we would also want to see that the maps are adopted by not just a simple majority of a legislature, but rather a supermajority of a legislature. But the best, I would say the best in class would be to have a nonpartisan commission doing the drawing of the maps within a state.
So we know that some states have more radically manipulated congressional district maps than others. Is the League targeting those states specifically?
No, we're targeting all states. We have just this past summer, we initiated a campaign, the National League initiated a nationwide campaign to basically eliminate racial and partisan gerrymandering. And that came right after the Supreme Court ruled that the issue, particularly on partisan gerrymandering, was not something that the Supreme Court or the judiciary at the national level was going to weigh in on the Supreme Court. Obviously, racial gerrymandering is governed by the Voting Rights Act, and that is something that the Supreme Court has weighed in on. But we do want to continue to make sure that whatever we do provides social justice. But we have targeted all 50 states and also the District of Columbia. The campaign that we have going forward, because each state is different, there's four different approaches that we're taking, and it's, each state gets to decide what is most suitable for their state. So, for instance, some states, it will be moving forward with ballot initiatives or referendums to have the voters say this is how we want to approach it. Oklahoma just started a petition, the League of Women Voters of Oklahoma, to put a ballot initiative on to set up a nonpartisan commission. We know this approach can be successful. The League was leaders in getting a nonpartisan commission put in place in Arizona and California. I think that was over 10 years ago. They also were involved in the Ohio campaign. So this is something that we know in states that have this type of political process is successful and is a good way for the voters to say, this is how we want our districts drawn. The next would be state constitutional options. And the objective there is to look at the state constitution. And as the previous speaker talked about, a lot of state constitutions do provide protection for voters in their state against partisan gerrymandering. And a good example of that was the Pennsylvania case that was cited. And again, the League in Pennsylvania was one of the co-plaintiffs in that suit that went up through the state courts. And of course, they decided that it was a partisan gerrymandering and redrew the maps to make it more representative of the people within the state. Then there's also state legislative fixes. There are about 34 states, I believe it is, that still have the legislature control the redistricting process. And that's the case in Massachusetts. And while we would, from a League standpoint, we believe a bipartisan commission is the better way to go. If a state legislature runs it in a very open process, a well-defined process, one that has public input into it, and is representative of the people in the state, that is something that we would work with our state leagues and our local leagues to ensure that happens and move forward in that way. And that's what we're planning to do as a state league in Massachusetts, is inform people how the process works and make sure that we're involved as citizens in the process moving forward. And then the last is federal legislative fixes, which would be at the the federal level, advocating for H.R. 1, which is for the People Act, and then also for the reinstatement of the Voting Rights Act.
Is there anything that can be done on the federal level that would prevent any special interest group from manipulating congressional districts?
The For the People Act, which has passed the House of Representatives, has a whole section in there and covers a lot of different stuff. But it does include money and politics in terms of regulating that. It also includes how guidelines in terms of redistricting, providing funds to states to do appropriate redistricting. So there are a lot of elements. It's a very broad act to really bring the democracy back into the hands of the voters so that the voice of the people is really represented in the Congress.
Are there any states that have safeguards in place to prevent this manipulation? And if so, are there models for how other states could be addressing this?
The states that have been doing the nonpartisan commissions, I think California would be one state to take a look at where they've been putting this in place. And it's also important once these commissions get put in place that the citizens pay attention that they are carried out as expected. Items such as making sure that the maps that are drawn up are obviously equal in population. There's rules that come down from the federal government in terms of guidelines for that. Also to make sure that it's effective representation for racial and linguistic minorities. And again, that comes from federal legislation in terms of guidance and rules on that. But also looking at are the communities, are they compact as appropriate? Are towns and counties or the smaller political units, are they in the same district or have they been split up? It's best to really try to keep those as much as possible, those political units in the same map. I know, for instance, in Texas, Austin, which is a huge city, is divided into four different congressional districts as part of the way they drew the maps. One would question, is that really a fair way for the citizens of Austin to have their voice heard and reflected in Congress? So we really want respect for those boundaries. And then also preservation and protection of communities of interest. The best way I think about that, I saw a map one time in California, and you can see one of the political maps or one of the districts is drawn where it kind of really stretches along the coast. And my first reaction was, that's not a very compact district. But then I thought about it, if you live on the coast, you've got a lot of different interests around the protection of that shoreline, the protection of the ocean, et cetera, or even your property, what might happen during a natural disaster, versus the people who live up in the mountains. So it's taking into account sometimes those type of issues that might be important. But again, that's best determined by the people in the state and why it's important to have the people who live in those communities be able to get their points of view across and considered as things are being drawn. Mm.
Massachusetts is historically a blue or Democratic state. Is there evidence of partisan gerrymandering here?
The data I've seen, information I've seen, and I think the next speaker can also speak to this, is that no. Over at the Tufts University, there's the Tisch College of Civic Engagement. There's a group called the Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group. And as if you look at the webpage, one of their studies says, you can draw, as many maps as there are stars in the sky for Massachusetts, and you're still going to come up with the way people vote currently with a Democratic representation from our state. So while we do have, certainly Republicans in the state, and we have a Republican governor, the people who are voting Republican for the representatives are spread throughout the state. They're not in one area. And likewise, when they did a study of the state Senate maps, they came to a similar conclusion that it's because the Republicans are spread out throughout the state, so that it's not gerrymandering. Now, it's not to say that a nonpartisan commission would be, it certainly could be a value in Massachusetts, simply to continue to build people's confidence in our state government. But in 2011, the process that was used was considered to be an open process and with a lot of public input. So it doesn't meet a lot of the criteria that the League has laid out in terms of doing redistricting.
2020 election is right around the corner, and as the 2020 census, which means the chance to redraw congressional district maps, is soon upon us, is there enough time to get these initiatives in place before the maps are redrawn?
Some of the states around the country have already been working on this. Some of the states that were mentioned earlier, the State League in Ohio, the State League in North Carolina. I mean, talk about people doing yeoman's work. It's just incredible down there. So a lot of those states have already have initiatives underway, and they're continuing to build their coalitions and public support and public education. That's a very important part to move us towards maps that really do represent the people. It is certainly something that we'd love to have in place completely by the drawing of the new maps. But we also, that would be a gold standard. But even if we don't get there, it's going to be something that the League across the country is going to continue to push for because it's so important for us, for our democracy.
Yeah. So for listeners concerned about ensuring fair mapping of congressional districts, what actions can they take?
There's a number of things. First of all, learn about it. Take a look and understand, because redistricting is not only important for congressional districts, it also goes down to our state level. It can go to your local level in terms of your city government or how your schools are set up. So just poke around a little bit. Read Ballotpedia, look on the website, see how things are done. Ask questions of your politicians. And so that's one way, civic engagement. I'm going to be giving a talk in Falmouth on, I think it's 7 p.m. on Thursday about this topic. So look around for groups that are talking about redistricting. There's also joining groups like the League of Women Voters or other groups, civic action groups that are focused on making sure that fair maps are drawn. From a federal level, write to your representative, write to your senator, and advocate for the passage of H.R. 1. And having that considered in the Senate, and then also the reinstatement of the Voting Rights Act is very important. And there's other topics such as D.C. statehood is another bill that is starting to go through Congress. So really helping advocate and support those federal level legislation is very important.
Judy Zombrecker is giving a talk, excuse me, as she mentioned, the League of Women Voters Fair Map Program at the Falmouth Public Library Thursday, 7 p.m. We'll post more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Judy, stay with us because after a short break, we discuss a new report examining how well Massachusetts elected leaders reflect the population of the Commonwealth. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Point, and we're discussing how to improve our representative democracy. With us is Judy Zombrecker, co-president of the Massachusetts chapter of the League of Women Voters. And joining us on the phone is Peter Levine, associate dean for academic affairs at Tufts Tisch College of Civic Life. He's also the co-author of a new report examining how well Massachusetts elected officials represent the diversity of the Commonwealth. Professor Levine, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what compelled you and the team to investigate if publicly elected officials in Massachusetts reflect the diversity of the electorate?
You know, I was pretty agnostic to start with. I think I maybe was a good author for this report because I didn't have a big axe to grind. And the topic was broader. It was just look at representative government in the state, local and statewide, and just see what's good and bad about it. But the finding that the state's leadership is tremendously unrepresentative really kind of jumped out as a major theme and a major finding.
Did the report focus just on the state legislature, or did you drill down to local office holders like, you know, select boards?
No, we drilled down. There's not great information statewide that I know of about select boards. We did note the in the gateway cities where the populations are heavily people of color, the almost all the mayors are white, and we had information about town meeting moderators, almost all of whom are white men. So we tried to cover the whole range, but the data is easiest to manage in the legislature.
Yeah. Judy, the League of Women Voters is active at the local level, hosting candidate debates and forums. Are there also efforts to help promote diversity in those seeking office?
Yes, as a league, we hold things such as how to run for office forums in our local towns to help people know what they can do to participate. And for instance, up in Salem, there was one that was run last year, and I know that I've talked to a few people who are diverse who actually have, based upon going to that, have decided that they may run for office. We also talk to people who are diverse and who have run for office, and what are the challenges, what are the opportunities they see in that, and then from a league standpoint, what can we do in our local communities to help promote a more diverse population to run for office. Mm.
Peter, what racial or ethnic groups have the least representation in the state legislature?
I think Asian Americans would have. In fact, there's 2% of the legislature is Asian. But African Americans are only 3%, for example. And then it gets worse as you go up the leadership ladder. So for example, of the 76 most powerful members of the entire legislature, 4 are people of color, which is pretty bad. So you have a better representation in the rank and file members than you do in the leadership.
What were your findings when you looked at the gender of office holders in comparison to the electorate?
Well, what's frustrating there is we're just stuck. We're at about a quarter, I think, of the legislature is female. But what's kind of striking about that is that it was the same in 1995, and things are getting better nationally. So our ranking as a gender balanced legislature keeps slipping almost one rank down a year or an election cycle. So So it's kind of amazing to me that we haven't made any progress there.
Do either of you have a sense of why so few women run for political office in Massachusetts? Judy?
Well, I was just writing a note here. One of I would not suggest this is the only reason, but for instance, there's a bill that we're advocating for in the state legislature to allow campaign funds to be used for child care expenses for women or anybody who would be running for office, and that would be a legitimate campaign expense. So there's things like that to take down those type of barriers, I think would be very important to encourage women to run for office. I'm thinking within my own town, I live in Concord, we actually have a pretty heavy representation of women in our local office overall. So hopefully as more women get into local office, they'll be encouraged to run then for state office.
Peter, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, those are good points. And the league does really important work, obviously. I would just throw in two other things. One is it's really hard for anybody new to break into state legislative office. We have, by some measures, the least competitive elections in the entire country. So the people who are in. So it's hard to change the demographic diversity for anybody. And the other thing that might be a little subtle but I think is really important is it's not clear to me that being a rank-and-file member of the House, of the State House, is a very great job. I mean, it has value, and many wonderful people seek that office, but power is so intensely concentrated in our State House, in the legislative leadership, that if you're somebody who wants to make change and you're talented and newcomer and you have a range of things you could do, including service in the nonprofit sector or the media or all kinds of things, or city government, town government, and one of the options is to be a rank-and-file State House member, which has typically one staffer assigned to it, that office. You can only do constituent service, which has no control over the agenda of the state. I'm not sure it's very desirable. So I think that's another thing that's holding us back and would make I've never done recruitment as Judy has, but I would guess that there's a lot of people who look at that job and think, actually, I'd rather not.
Yeah. We're talking about how to improve our representative democracy this hour. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Bruce writes, I'm an independent living on the Cape. I sometimes vote Democratic, sometimes Republican, sometimes other. However, I feel like my vote doesn't count here in the 9th District. If you look at the shape of our district, it reaches up specifically to grab the densely populated Democratic stronghold around Quincy. A Republican will never have a chance in our district. I agree that the Republicans have been more public about their strategy to shape districts to their advantage, but my view is that both parties do it, including Democrats in our state. In this day and age, we should use computer algorithms and or nonpartisan commissions to make representative districts a reality. And that's sort of, Judy, what we've been talking about, right?
Yes. Peter can probably comment more on the work that's being done by the group at Tufts that looks at the geometry. They look at it from a geometry standpoint, past voting records, and that's where they came up with the conclusion that with regards to the congressional district, and certainly understand what the caller was talking about, but as they looked at the districts and ran through all the different computer models and voting records, their conclusion was that we do live in a Democratic, a state that leans Democratic, and that's what our congressional district delegation would look like, regardless of how those maps had been drawn.
Yeah, Peter?
Yeah, no, that's very well summarized. I mean, I guess I sort of agree with the caller's right that there's a problem with legitimacy. It just doesn't, if I were an independent in the 9th District, I would be suspicious too, and we don't want people to be suspicious. So, and it's a reasonable suspicion. So I would support a redistricting commission or algorithms, but I don't think it had actually changed the composition of the legislature. That's according to my brilliant mathematician colleague Moon Duchin, and her basic method is just to, as Judy said, to generate literally tens of thousands of random maps for the state and look at the distribution of what happens if you took random maps. And it's actually literally impossible. It is mathematically impossible to produce a single majority congressional Republican congressional district in our state, because Republicans are distributed across it. And with the Senate, yes, you can get some majority districts, but it looks like we have as many majority Republican districts, but it looks like we have as many as you could get. So it's the right reform, but it won't actually change the balance. And of course, independents always have a beef in our political system, which tends towards the two-party dominance, and I understand and respect that, but redistricting wouldn't get us to more independent votes in the legislature.
Peter, did the report look at how other marginalized communities, such as LGBTQ, are represented in public office?
We didn't really, and that's I'm accountable for that. I mean, we should, although it's much harder to get data. So we really looked at race, ethnicity, gender, and also immigration status. I don't have that. I didn't memorize that number, but I think very, very few state legislators were born outside the United States, but a significant proportion of the Commonwealth was.
Peter, why is it important that elected officials not just reflect the political diversity of citizens, but also race and gender of the electorate?
You get different results, for one thing. It's been shown over and over again by political scientists that if a legislature reflects a demographic group, the demographic group does better out of public policy. So it's built-in unfairness if a whole lot of white people are making policy for a state that's substantially diverse. 29% of our Commonwealth is people of color, but hardly anyone in the legislature. But also another kind of argument I would make is that we're not tapping the talents and energies and perspectives of our people all the way up from local level to the state, all the way from the voter, from the electorate, to the leadership of the state, so the state house. We're not taking advantage of all the things that people know and can do. We have a very narrow group, demographically narrow, but also they're just a very small number of people making huge decisions for our state because of the degree of centralization in the legislature, just not very many human beings. And then they're the same people year after year. So we're not doing as well as we could if we tapped into more.
Yeah. Judy, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think that also we need to get more voices, even have more contested elections. In 2018, we did an online voter guide, and there were so many races, both at the primary and at the state, in the general election, that were uncontested. By having not only more people, but a more diverse group of people with their voices being heard and discussed in the public forum, I think is critical for us as moving forward as a state. Mm.
And Peter, the report found that many those seats do go uncontested, right?
And there's a pattern too of people quitting. It's quite common. People, legislators quitting in mid session. It's only it's a quick session anyway, but quitting in the middle, so that there's a special election, which is then either uncontested or has a tremendously low turnout. And so it certainly looks as if, and in some cases it's definitely the case, that the seat has just been set aside for somebody who's been cherry-picked in advance to fill it. And that's particularly dispiriting.
Yeah. Judy, what are thoughts on how we get more candidates to run for political office?
That's a good question.
Because Peter brought up a good point earlier. Yeah. Sometimes it's a very thankless job. It's an important job.
Right.
But, running for office is tough.
Yeah, the league doesn't recruit people to run for office. We educate people on how our government works. As I said, we run things like how to run for office forums and what these offices entail. I would suggest that goes back to the political parties. The Republicans and the Democrats in the state need to think about how do they get more people to run? Do they want more people to run for these offices?
Yeah. Peter, the report drew attention to the fact, as you're mentioning, in the House, power is not equally distributed among all representatives. So what are some ways to address this imbalance in power in the state house?
Probably a lot of ways, but we have a pretty particular recommendation that I'd love to mention, which is that there needs to be a lot more staff, and the staff needs to be more evenly distributed. So, again, the typical House member has one person working for her or him, and that person is just going to do constituent service. So the typical House member can't do any legislating, can't develop a proposal, figure out how much it's going to cost, consider alternatives, hold hearings, none of that. So we would like to see the average rank-and-file member get more staff support, and we'd also like to see some nonpartisan staffing for the whole body. So we're one of a very small number of states which doesn't have a nonpartisan research arm. Usually
there's a nonpartisan research arm, and a member of the legislature can ask it to do a study of something, figure out how much this would cost, for example, and we don't have any capacity for that. So all that capacity is in the leadership.
Mm. And the report suggests other reforms to create more participation and better representation in state government. You got synchronized state and local elections for better voter turnout and officials more beholden to the voters, not special interest groups, public funds for candidates and political parties, better funding of public interest reporting. Making some of the changes that you recommend will require support and action from the state legislature. Are there any indications that the body is receptive to addressing some of these issues?
I would also like to hear what Judy thinks. I think that those new members who are coming in are quite different, and they're somewhat restive, and there's some push for reform. So I actually am optimistic over the middle term. I just don't know how quick it'll be.
Yeah. Judy?
I agree with Peter. I think it'll be something that we all need to work at. I believe that there's a lot of civic groups. Certainly the League continues to advocate for more transparency and in terms of how votes are taken, how things got out of the committee, which I believe is some of the reforms that the new members are looking for. And there's other groups. So we have a lot of coalitions we work with. And I think pulling together coalitions, presenting a good case, and then working with our legislatures and advocate for those will help move things forward. But it's not a silver bullet, and it's going to be something that we all have to focus on for a while.
Yeah. So just about a minute, Peter. Were there particular areas in the state where there was a wider disparity between elected officials and their constituents?
I'm not sure, but I would point to the lack of mayors in the gateway cities is pretty dramatic.
Yeah. And I'll say, for interesting, in our little corner here in the Cape and Islands, we usually are pretty much, equal number Republicans and Democrats, which is not reflective of the rest of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll post a link to the Mass Forward Report, a collaboration of Mass Inc. and Tufts University, at our website, capeandislands.org. Peter Levine, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at Tufts Tisch College of Civic Life and co-author of the Mass Forward Report. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Judy Zonbrecker, co-president of the Massachusetts chapter of the League of Women Voters. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to David Goodman and Gary Mott for production assistance in Boston. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.